You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 363, Revelation 3, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Well, Trey, I'm doing well, but I still don't have an office.
Uh-oh. So you're...
So I'm huddled here in my bedroom at my little desk doing the Naked Bible Podcast. But hey, it's not going to affect the content, but still don't have my office back.
Yeah, but you're expecting it next week, right?
I am. I'll be able to get in a few days and start unpacking, digging out. You know, it seems like I'm always digging out of holes or something, you know, but such as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some comedy in there somewhere, but I'm going to restrain you.
Right. We can't quite find it right now.
I'm going to restrain myself from that.
See it from a distance.
I'm going to be a good boy. Okay. Well, hey, Mike, I got a question. You know, some people were having some confusion on following your logic through the first part of Revelation here.
I can't believe that anyone would be confused when we're talking about the book of Revelation. I can't believe it.
Mentioned it on the introduction of Revelation. So I think maybe people are just not following along here, but they're misunderstanding your angle that you're taking. And if John is writing what he saw and heard, then why are you saying things like, you know, John wanted to hook back into the Old Testament, and that it sounds like that you're saying that John, you know, these are John's thoughts and his message to these churches, not John writing all he's experiencing or being told to write. So can you clarify that a little bit?
Yeah. So if I can distill that question, the question is this a record, John's record of a vision, or is John thinking back into the Old Testament? And the answer is yes. Okay. Both of these things can be true at the same time. Let's just put ourselves in real time with John, you know, as it were. When John has a vision, he's not writing during the vision, because vision-like states, trance-like states, whatever we want to describe these things, they are what they are. You know, he's not interrupting the angel and, you know, writing things down like a stenographer or something like this. He's not capturing it on video. He's experiencing something. And then after the fact, he sets it to writing. And in the process of setting it to writing, it's going to dawn on him, either because of what he knows in terms of the Old Testament or biblical theology, or he's going to be prompted by the Spirit of God to make connections, and he's going to make them. I mean, let's just use an example from the introduction. Solecisms. You know, there's a couple dozen of these where John's grammar, his Greek grammar, is wrong. It's incorrect. Where everywhere else in the book, it's perfectly fine. And again, scholars have figured out that when this happens, the explanation is there's something that John's drawing on back in the Septuagint that he could convert to correct grammar, but he doesn't. Because he wants you to sort of think about what's, you know, like why is he saying it that way instead of the better way to say this? And, you know, he wants readers to go back and look at things. It's a way of drawing attention. And there are very clear instances in the book where John takes 2, 3, 4 passages from the Old Testament and mixes them. I mean, literally, these are just a matter of looking up the Greek text that John has given us, and going back and looking at the Septuagint. This is something that if you know Greek fairly well, your first, second year knowledge, you can just go check for yourself. That doesn't mean John didn't have a vision. Okay, it just means that both of these things can be simultaneously true. So John has this experience, then after the fact, he has to relate that experience to his audience. And in so doing, he's going to be doing the kinds of things that we're talking about here. So one doesn't cancel out the other. They work, you know, in tandem. So that, again, that's my approach to this, because A, I don't deny that visions can happen to people like John, you know, visions from God. And B, you can actually go look this stuff up textually and see what's being done. So I'm not of the mode to deny either, and don't see any compelling reason why I have to deny one or the other. Both of these things can be operative at the same time.
All right, Mike. Yeah, I think, I mean, he's got to convey what he saw. So what better way than to use the tools that he's familiar with and the people are familiar with?
Right. He's going to discern what the point is of what he's seeing, or he's going to be told by the angel. I mean, the angel could relate something in the Old Testament, and John, you know, is going to, you know, be alerted to this fact. And so after, you know, he relates it to his audience, you know, there's going to be some of this thing going on to make sure the audience doesn't miss the point. You know, this is, inspiration is a human and supernatural enterprise. Both of these things are operative. One does not cancel out the other, nor should one cancel out the other. We shouldn't talk about the subject trying to avoid one or the other. This is, you know, going back to what I say frequently on the podcast. If we deny the human element of inspiration, we undermine the doctrine in very significant ways. And if that sounds a little strange, maybe to a new listener, you know, the short path is to go Google that in a podcast transcript. But there's plenty of places on YouTube and whatnot where I'm talking about why we need a better view of inspiration, and you'll find out why I say that.
All right, sounds good. Well, Mike, we're wrapping up Revelation 3. This is part 2, so might as well just get into it.
Yes, we are. We might as well get into it. I mean, this will be a bit lengthy, but it's really interesting stuff. Again, it's the kind of stuff we like. It's the weird stuff. So this episode is, you know, I've labeled it part 2 of Revelation 3, and we're taking as our point of focus Revelation 3, 7. But this is also going to be related back to Revelation 1:18. And what I'm going to do is I'm basically going to start with Revelation 1:18, and then we'll hit Revelation 3:7 at some point and see how these two things go together. And it's the link between the two is this keys language. So let me just read the passage, or passages really. Revelation 3:7 says, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens." And then Revelation 1:18, I'm going to loop verse 17 into it so it just sounds more readable. It says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not, I am the first and the last, and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades.'" Now, there are several really excellent resources on this passage, Revelation 1:18, and related passages like chapter 3, verse 7, that give you its contextual roots. Now, I'm going to give you two sources here, two resources for those who are interested in really getting into the weeds. One of these is really easy to find, and the other one, not so much. You know, and the one that's easy to find is also inexpensive. And I want to give a hat tip here and a thanks to one of our listeners, Robert Cruikshank, for these recommendations, and they're quite good for this passage. Now, the one that isn't expensive and is easy to find is by Justin W. Bass, B-A-S-S. It's called, the title is The Battle for the Keys: Revelation 1:18 and Christ's Descent into the Underworld. And it's published by Wiffenstock. It's part of the Paternoster Biblical Monographs series, and it was published in 2014. Now, we're going to have Justin on as an interview. At least we're planning on it, so Lord willing, that'll happen for a future interview. We're not going to talk so much about this book. We'll be focused on a different book. But this is, you know, sort of an off-the-radar biblical theology book that really he does a great job with this. The book is blurbed and recommended by W. Hall Harris, who's a New Testament prophet, Dallas Seminary, and was a mentor to Justin during his dissertation process, and this is his dissertation. And you, some of you who have read Unseen Realm will recognize that name as well, Hall Harris. I, in the book Unseen Realm, I take Hall's view of the descent of Christ to the underworld, you know, in Ephesians 4, and how that relates to Psalm 68 and all that kind of stuff. So this is going to be more of that. It's going to add more layers to it. The second source is by David Onn, who I've referenced before in terms of his commentary on the book of Revelation. You know, we dip into that almost every episode somewhere. But he has a book called Apocalypticism, Prophecy, and Magic in Early Christianity. This is a Moore Seebeck title, 2006. And this one is more expensive, a little harder to find, but both of these have a lot of really good contextual material for Revelation 1:18 and Revelation 3:7. And I'm going to be dipping into both during this episode, mostly Bass, but you know, also interacting with Onn's work in this monograph. So let's take the two passages in the order they appear. They are, of course, related, but they're not identical. Okay, Revelation 1:17, 18, again, just to refresh our memory. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Fear not, I am the first and the last, and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades." Now, Onn, in this apocalypticism book, this monograph, says this. The phrase, "I have the keys to death and Hades," refers to the cosmic sovereignty to which Jesus has attained following the act of God raising him from the dead. All three elements are featured in the brief description of the Lamb in Revelation 5:6 as well. The Lamb was standing as though slain with seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Here, standing refers to the fact that he's now living. In other words, he's not laying over dead, okay? Despite the fact that he was slain. And the seven eyes, understood as the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth, is another symbolic way of emphasizing the sovereignty, in this case, of Jesus, who is the Lamb. Now, you know, we talked about the eyes of the Lord running to and fro in a couple episodes and how that denotes God's oversight of everything, sovereignty. So that's familiar. But here, that the language in Revelation 5 is transferred to the Lamb who was slain but is now standing and raised. And again, that language harkens back to Revelation 1:17 and 18. Now, there's a grammatical issue that Onn points out in Revelation 1:18. He writes this a little bit further. The prophetic call narrative in Revelation 1:9 through 20 is a complex pastiche of imagery drawn from various sources. And boy, don't we know that. Onn says, a supernatural revealer like a son of man appears to John and claims to possess the keys, and he has here two, death and Hades. Now, he translates it a little bit differently, and he has a footnote here. This is the grammatical issue. He says, the genitives, tu thanatu and tu hadu. Genitive is, let me just break in here, is a grammatical term for the relationship of two nouns that follow each other, okay, or an article, you know, plus a noun. So for those of you who had a little Greek, you know, you know right away what we're talking about here, but there's different ways to understand the relationship of nouns, let's just put it that way, in not just Greek, but any language. So Onn says, these phrases could either be objective or possessive genitives. In other words, you could translate this, the keys to death and Hades, that would be the objective mode of understanding, or you could translate it, the keys, you know, belonging to death and Hades, that would be possessive. So one says the keys to death and Hades, like they're a place that you can go and unlock something. And the other one is more possessive, that death and Hades possesses, you know, these keys. They belong to them. Onn says, if they are regarded as objective genitives, death and Hades must be understood spatially, as in Revelation 20, verses 13 and 14. They're, in other words, they're places with spatiality. But if they are construed as possessive genitives, death and Hades must be understood as personifications, as in Revelation 6:8. So let me just break in here again. On saying both of these things happen with death and Hades in the book of Revelation. Sometimes it's a place, sometimes they're like persons, or figures, entities, okay? Back to Onn. The first possibility is preferable, in this case, he says, this is his view, since death is never, to my knowledge, to his knowledge, described in ancient texts as possessing keys, and there are few, if any, ancient texts in which Hades is so described. Pausanias, he points out, describes a decorated table showing Plutus holding a key. Again, but the same text distinguishes him from Hades, whom he has locked up. So he's saying, look, he drifts away from the personification view. Now, personally, I think that's unnecessary. And what we're going to go through in this episode is basically going to be pushback on this point. I've already hinted that I favor, personification a little bit. Bass argues at length for it. Okay. And he has very good reasons for doing so. And you might say, well, this feels like a bit of a distinction without a difference, because, hey, the personified death and Hades are masters of a particular domain. So the other idea of the spatiality is still in play. I agree. I think both of these things, belong on the table, both of these perspectives. But I want to focus a little bit on the personification angle, at least initially here. So let's start with the Old Testament. Here's the question. Are death and Hades, Hades the underworld, are they ever personified? Are they ever portrayed as figures, entities, deities? Okay, elsewhere, especially in the Old Testament or in the literature that informs the terms used in the Old Testament? The answer to that is, oh yeah, yeah, they are. Now, I'm going to refer to DDD here, Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible. And the article on death is written by John Healy. And he gives us a good survey, sort of the background to the Old Testament material. Now, what you need to know here is that in Hebrew, the Hebrew Bible, the term for death is, the noun anyway, is mot. That is the same word in Ugaritic, mot, and in Ugaritic, mot is a deity, part of a pantheon, okay? So this is going to be the backdrop for, again, the Old Testament use in certain passages of the term mot or death. But first, we got to get the background material. So Healy writes, Mot's absence from the Ugaritic cult, in other words, there's no rituals or sacrifices to Mot, and his absence in personal names suggests that he was not a deity worshipped like others in the pantheon, but he's nevertheless a deity figure. In Ugaritic mythology, Mot is one of the main enemies of Baal, alongside Yam, the sea god, who, unlike Mot, was the object of cultic veneration to some extent. Mot overcomes Baal, and the latter has to descend into Mot's underworld domain. So the Baal cycle has this battle between Mot, death, and Baal. Baal loses, and Baal has to go into the underworld. Okay, so what we read afterward is Baal is reported dead in the Ugaritic tablets. I'm not going to give you the KTU numbers. It's not important now. But the goddess Anat hunts for him, and she attacks Mot, who is vanquished. So she takes care of Mot. Baal revives, and the two protagonists fight. Eventually, Mot is forced to concede, at least temporarily. The details are, of course, far from certain. The main characteristic of Mot is that he is a voracious consumer of both gods and men. He has an enormous mouth and an appetite to match. In his voraciousness, Mot is closely associated with the underworld. Mot dwells in the underworld, which is an unpleasant, muddy place of decay and destruction. The role of Mot as a demonic force to be held in check is well illustrated in Ugaritic texts. Then he has a reference. Although there is no certain iconographic representation of Mot, there's no artwork that tells you what they thought Mot looked like, such suggestions as have been made involve images of a god or demon carrying a scepter. In other words, he's a ruler. Okay, so this is the Old Testament Canaanite backdrop to Mot as an entity. Now, when you get into the Old Testament, Healy in the same article writes this. In Old Testament poetry, death is often personified. For example, Hosea 13:14. I'm just going to read Hosea 13:14. It won't be the last time that we reference that, perhaps, in this episode. It says, I shall ransom them. And again, the speaker is going to be God here. I shall ransom them from the power of Sheol. I shall redeem them from death. Now, that there, it's kind of neutral, like a place. But then the verse says, O death, like it's death is being addressed, Mot is being addressed. Where are your plagues? O Sheol, O underworld, where is your sting? compassion is hidden from my eyes. Now, some of you automatically, even though you didn't know that was Hosea 13:14, you've heard that language before, and it's in Paul. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, you know, the place where the dead go. Where's your sting? Where's your victory? Again, the point is that death and the underworld here are portrayed as entities that can be spoken to, or in this case, teased or mocked by Hosea 13:14. Healy writes, in other texts, there is mention of specific characteristics of death, which have some sort of parallel in the picture of mote painted by the Ugaritic texts. Thus, in Habakkuk 2:5, the insatiability of personified death is mentioned. Quote, this is what the verse says, whose greed is as wide as Sheol, and like death, he is never satisfied. Again, it's sort of anthropomorphic language. This may echo the background cultural tradition of mote, but the comparison is with the insatiability of the arrogant man and does not directly touch on matters religious, Healy writes. The same idea, though applied to a personified Sheol, again the underworld, is found in Isaiah 5:14. Quote, therefore Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure, unquote. Again, this is anthropomorphic language used of Sheol. In some cases it's death, other cases it's Sheol, and portrayed as a person. And, you know, there's other passages that do this, but this is sufficient to make the point. Healy goes on and says, let me just make the point here, because I think something Bass says here is a little bit better. In the Old Testament, okay, we have this personification. In the rest of Second Temple literature, again, this is going to show up too, but everybody goes to Sheol in, you know, the Hebrew Bible, in Old Testament theology, because everybody dies. The only exceptions are people that God sort of exempts from this. And there's only two of these in the Hebrew Bible. There's Enoch and Elijah. So Bass, writing about the Old Testament, you know, death and, you know, Hades, or actually, you know, mote and Sheol, wants to make this point because he's going to do something again with it when he gets going here. He says, there's no Old Testament instance of a true descent to and return from the underworld by a living human being. Let me just read that again. Let that sink in. There's no Old Testament instance of a true descent to and return from the underworld by a living human being. I could stop right there, and you probably are gonna know. You're going to be already seeing the significance of Revelation 1:18 and 3:7 with this death and Hades thing, because Jesus does that. He does descend and he does return to the land of the living. He's not just revived in the underworld like Osiris or something like that. What happens with Jesus goes well beyond that, and it's something that just didn't happen in the Old Testament. So Bass, continuing, says, in fact, Enoch and Elijah are the only exceptions who can be found to have gone to heaven and remain there instead of Sheol or Hades before New Testament times. Jewish and Christian writings after the time of Jesus begin to speak of the Old Testament saints in heaven, such as Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Jacob's children, or Job's children, excuse me, and the souls of the righteous that go to the third heaven, you know, language like this. Deliverance from Sheol is the great hope of the faithful Israelite, and there is no evidence in the Old Testament that it had been fulfilled. The righteous are at peace in death, Isaiah 57:1-2, and they hope to be united with their bodies for a physical resurrection, Ezekiel 37:12-14, Isaiah 26:19, Daniel 12:2. But his point is that in the Old Testament, that never happens. They never get to experience that, you know, in terms of what's written in the Old Testament. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we've got, you know, soul sleep or anything like this, because, you know, there are these expressions of hope. I'm going to go be with my fathers, you know, buried with his fathers. And, you know, we know from archaeology, we've been through this material elsewhere on the podcast, you know, when we talk about like Psalms of Korah and, you know, deliverance from Sheol and all this stuff. This ought to be familiar territory, but in case it's not, just want to hit a little of it. Again, the point is everybody goes to Sheol because everybody dies. The only two exceptions, Enoch and Elijah. Okay, we got them. And once you're in Sheol in the Old Testament, nobody ever gets out. there's hope that you will get out at the last day, that the Lord will take you out, will redeem the righteous, okay? But you know, there's no passage that says they do. In the intertestamental period, people start writing in this way, again, about that the deliverance, you know, from Sheol is now like real, you know, like you know, their perspective on, you know, the afterlife shifts a little bit, or it develops a little bit to include this. And of course, in the New Testament, this is very plainly articulated in various passages. But it's Jesus who sort of makes it a reality for everybody, you know, all the righteous anyway. Okay, so you know, there's this growth in the way this is thought about, the afterlife is thought about, growth and understanding. You know, the hope becomes reality. And if you're looking at Old and New Testament, it's very clear who the one is who makes it a reality. That would be Jesus, okay? First fruits of them who sleep. I mean, these phrases actually mean something in the context of the Hebrew Bible and just how this whole subject is thought about. So Bass, you know, going on, notes that in some passages, at least one, clearly, explicitly, well, that's a better way to say it, Sheol, okay, and let me just read it. Being gathered to one's fathers, okay, this idea of you know, going to be with your loved ones is parallel with Sheol in Genesis 49:29. If being gathered to one's fathers or sleeping with your fathers is parallel with Sheol, then it is clear that even the righteous go to Sheol, even the ones who expect a positive experience, maybe expect, you know, something more, to be with the Lord, you know, as certain psalms say. So everybody goes to Sheol, righteous and unrighteous. Nobody gets out in the Old Testament, even though that is the hope of the righteous. So that's sort of a summary of Old Testament thinking when it comes to, you know, what happens when you die. Now, Bass wants to make that point again, because he's later going to point to how Jesus is the unique factor here. He's the one that makes it a reality, so to speak. Not just so to speak, but really. But in biblical theology, Jesus is the turning point. He's the linchpin to all this. But then he goes on and he says, we need to say something about personification language too. Now, just think about it before I even get into this. You know, we've talked a little bit about personification already, but I'm going to do a little bit more here with what Bass has written. Everybody goes to this place. Everybody dies. So there's the death problem. Everybody goes to the underworld. Okay. And it's not really a great place. I mean, yep, you might, if you're fortunate, you know, you might get to see your loved ones and all that, but you're still there. You're still like a prisoner. You know, you're still never going to get out. You hope to get out to be with the Lord directly, to experience his presence. Okay. That's even better than being gathered to your fathers. Okay, you want to be with the Lord that you serve, that you worship, that you believe in, so on and so forth. That's the hope. But death and the underworld are in your way. They hold you prisoner. It's as though you're in a cell and they have keys. Again, it's prison metaphor. It's inescapability. You know, this kind of metaphor. You know, think in those terms. Wouldn't it be great if somebody could come down there and basically take the lunch money from death and the underworld, take the keys, and let those people out that are aligned with him, that are righteous, that follow him? I mean, when you start thinking in those terms, you're thinking of spiritual warfare, you're thinking of divine warrior conflict, you're thinking of some kind of battle thing. You know, you're thinking of somebody going down there and like I said, taking their lunch money. Okay, I'm here now. Hand them over. The keys are mine, not yours any longer. There's a spiritual war, a spiritual battle with death and Hades. And Jesus is going to win that fight. That's the imagery that is lurking behind Revelation 1:18. And Revelation 3:7. But let's go, you know, I've tipped the hand here. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Bass has a nice summary of personification language, and part of it reads as follows. This is Old Testament stuff now. Many see this personified figure, death, as Mot, the Canaanite god from Ugaritic texts, with very similar characteristics to death in the Old Testament. We've already hinted at that with Healy's article. To illustrate, Bass says, death uses waves of the sea against his victims, 2 Samuel 22, 5 and 6. He uses cords and snares, Psalm 17, 5 through 6. Okay, Psalm 114, 3, Proverbs 13, 14, so on. He ascends through windows, Jeremiah 9, 21. He kills, Job 18, 13, Jeremiah 18, 21. Death terrorizes people, Psalm 54, 5. He consumes, Job 15, 21. He's never satisfied, Habakkuk 2, 5. He crushes, Job 30, 23. He speaks, Job 28, 22. He shepherds, you know, people under his ownership, Psalm 48, 15. He is the enemy of man, Song of Solomon 8, 6. He has weapons, Psalm 7, 13. He's sent by God, Isaiah 9, 7, Habakkuk 3, 13. He meets people, Proverbs 24, 8. Daniel 2, 9, and he can be called upon, Job 17, 14. It's all personification language. Similarly, Sheol, Hades, not just death, but the, you know, Hades, the place, is predominantly the realm of the underworld, but also can be personified as being as a being that unleashes terror. Sheol, or Hades, is personified through the Old Testament as seizing his victims, Job 24, 19. Never being satisfied, Proverbs 27, 20. He's an irresistible power, again, Song of Solomon 8, 6. Terrorizes with weapons, again, Psalm 17, 6. Has a house, Job 17, 13, and Job 30, 23. Has a hand, Psalm 48, 15, and 16. Has a belly, Jonah 2, 3. Has a mouth to feed on his victims, Isaiah 5, 13. And can be embittered, at least in the Septuagint, Isaiah 14, 9. And is naked before God, Job 26, 6. And again, this is all personification language. This is his point. Now, you take all that and you see the same thing in Second Temple Jewish literature and Greco-Roman literature. Bass has a whole chapter dedicated to the personification of death and Hades in Greco-Roman literature and Second Temple material. Here's a short paragraph from it. Beginning in Homer, Hades is personified as the god of the underworld and is the brother of Zeus. Moreover, the underworld is predominantly personified as the god Hades. Hades is, quote, horrible, and, quote, the most hated of all the gods. Hades was worshipped in a temple near Elis in Greece. He is also pictured as judge of the dead. Hades is simultaneously portrayed not only as the god of the underworld, but also the very realm of the underworld that houses the souls of the dead. The dead are frequently referred to as entering the house of Hades. There is a river or lake that is the boundary between the dead and the living, and a ferryman that takes the dead across to pass through the gates of Hades. In Greek mythology, even death is personified as a demon or a monster from the underworld who is the sacrificer of the dead, quote unquote. It is clear that the Greeks sometimes personified Hades as a god of the underworld and simultaneously understood Hades as the abode or realm of the dead. In other words, to the Greek mind, they're both on the table, just like we said earlier. Finishing with Bass, he says, I believe this Greek portrayal of Hades as ruler over the dead and realm of the dead find clear parallels in the Old Testament and especially in Revelation. Again, Second Temple writers noted all this stuff. I'm not going to bother to read all of the, you know, the whole section here. I'll just, again, just a few sentences. Here's some Second Temple Jewish examples. The Book of Wisdom makes clear that God did not create death, Wisdom 1:13. It was through the devil's envy that death entered into the world, Wisdom 2:24. Death can be seen as a realm or state of being or personified. To illustrate, death can be summoned by mankind to make a covenant, Wisdom 1:16. Death is summoned by God to take Abraham. That's the Testament of Abraham 8, 9 through 12 and 16 through 20. Death decrees things. Sirach 41, 2 and 3 has a hand. Song of the Three Jews, 188. You know, so on and so forth. You know, swallows up sinners, 1 Enoch 56, 8. Oppresses people, 1 Enoch 63, 11. Is destructive, Sibylline Oracles 3.393. He's a dragon that feeds on the wicked, 3 Baruch 4, 6, and must be tamed. Apocalypse of Abraham 10:11. Again, just on and on and on. But the whole point is that when you get up to the New Testament, there's a long history of thinking about death and the underworld, death, we'll use the Revelation language, death and Hades, as being both a place and an entity, a supernatural being. They're both in view. When you get to the New Testament, Bass writes this, more specifically, the book of Revelation uses Hades four times, always paired with death, and the two of them are personified agents of evil that Christ will and has overcome. Revelation 1:18, Revelation 6:8, Revelation 20:13 and 14. Those are the four passages where they're paired. However, Hades as a city with gates and souls dwelling within it is still clearly present in Revelation as well. Revelation 20:13. Death is also personified throughout the New Testament. In a footnote, he lists these references, Romans 5:14 and 17, Romans 6:9, 1 Corinthians 15:26, 54 and 55, 2 Timothy 1:10, Hebrews 2:14, and then you get into Revelation. He says, so death is personified a lot, but only Hades is personified in Revelation. These, again, these four passages where they're paired are also the only four places in the New Testament where death and Hades appear together. So it's only those four. Bass writes, the author of Revelation is the only writer of the New Testament who continues to portray death and Hades as a duo of terror against mankind, as has been shown to be somewhat normative in the Old Testament and Second Temple literature. So all of that to say, look, what he's going to say about this has deep roots in the Hebrew Bible, Second Temple Jewish literature, and Greco-Roman thinking. And that is this whole idea that Christ is going to descend to this realm and defeat death and Hades in terms of spiritual warfare, like divine entities, supernatural agents. And I'll use the phrase again, take their lunch money. He's going to take the keys by force, as it were, and they're going to be dethroned. They're going to be put out of a job. Okay? They are no longer going to be owners of these keys. So again, this is the imagery to keep in mind. Keys, he says on 59 and 60, keys had a very important place in the ancient Jewish and Greco-Roman world. The Jewish, Roman, and Greek writers wanted to present their gods as the one who hold the keys to the underworld. The imagery used to describe both the underworld and heaven is consistent in the ancient world. The underworld was presented as protected by strong and impenetrable gates that required keys to enter. You know, think of the prison metaphor, and you get the idea. Bass continues, therefore, we have numerous angels and gods and goddesses who are said to possess the keys to these gates in various ancient religions. Another predominant figure in the ancient Greco-Roman world who is said in multiple places to have the keys of the underworld is the goddess Hecate, also known as Persephone or Artemis or Diana. In fact, On argues that Jesus holding the keys to death and Hades is a polemic directly against the Hellenistic conceptions of the goddess Hecate. Hecate was the primary figure in the ancient Greco-Roman world to be associated with having the keys to Hades. Hecate is also known as Artemis in magic papyri texts, where she's referred to, get this, quote, mother of all things, for you frequent Olympus, and the broad and boundless chasm you traverse, beginning and end are you. Does that sound familiar? I'm the beginning, and I'm the end. Beginning and end are you, and you alone rule all. For all things are from you, and in you do all things, eternal one, come to their end. And you hold in your hands a golden scepter. So there's lordship and authority. She's given multiple titles here that are exclusively used for God and Christ in Revelation. Hecate is the beginning and the end. Compare Revelation 21:6, 22:13. She alone rules all and holds a golden scepter. Check Revelation 4:11, you know, for that imagery. Now, Bass, again, there's just a lot of material. He goes and he talks about, you know, Egyptian stuff and Anubis, other Greco-Roman deities. You know, when he moves to Second Temple material, there's an interesting couple of sentences here. He says, when we move into the Jewish literature before and after the time of the New Testament, angels are predominantly said to possess the keys. Among them, among these angels are Metatron, Yahoel, Eremiel or Uriel, and the archangel Michael. They are all said to possess the keys to either the underworld or the kingdom of heaven. Instead of having the keys to the levels of heaven, other angels are said to have the keys to Hades. Now, that's the end of the quote. For me, the most interesting one there is Ya'ol, which is Yahoel. And if you've ever heard me lecture on the two powers in heaven in Jewish literature, you know that name. Okay, Metatron is another. They're the most interesting because Yahoel was the second power to a number of Jews. So if you're thinking that, you got two powers thinking, you got binatarian thinking, binatarian Jewish monotheism. But for the New Testament and John, who really holds the keys? It's Jesus. I mean, it figures right into this flow, this trajectory of thought. Now, Eremiel is interesting, though, and I'm going to read a little bit about him, what Bass says about his imagery, this other angel. He says, the apocalypse of Zephaniah has striking parallels with the first vision of Revelation. Zephaniah says, then I arose and stood, and I saw a great angel standing before me with the face shining like the rays of the sun in its glory, since his face is like that which is perfected in its glory. And he was girded as if a golden girdle were upon his breast. His feet were like bronze which is melted in a fire. And when I saw him, I rejoiced, for I thought that the Lord Almighty had come to visit me. I fell upon my face, and I worshipped him. He said to me, take heed, don't worship me. I am not the Lord Almighty, but I am the great angel Eremiel, who is over the abyss and Hades, the one in which all the souls are imprisoned from the end of the flood, which came upon the earth until this day. It's the end of the quote. Now, clearly, Eremiel has replaced Christ in this vision. You know, Bass notes that Christ has replaced Eremiel if Revelation was written after the apocalypse of Zephaniah, or they're both using a common source, you know, if it's before. You know, either way, Christ is presented as deity in Revelation because he accepts worship from John. Did you catch that difference? See, everything that I just read to you sounds really like Revelation 1, except for one detail. Okay, Jesus doesn't say, oh, don't worship me. I mean, it's just really clever. Again, if you are a literate Jew, and you're familiar with the apocalypse of Zephaniah and the keys stuff and all the stuff we've been talking about to this point, and you get to Revelation 1 and you're familiar with this apocalypse passage, and, it's just like this other guy wrote, except for one thing. Jesus does not refuse to be worshipped. In fact, the imagery of him is aligned with the Ancient of Days. We've already talked about this. He is the one who has the keys of death and Hades. Okay, and he's God. Okay, I mean, how many ways can John say it? How many ways can John take a familiar idea to his readers? Again, because he has to describe what the angel has shown him, whether it's a vision or something the angel shows him, or both, you know. It's like six of one and a half, a dozen of another. And it's strategic, okay? You know, I'm sure when John's having the vision, you know, the angel doesn't say, now, when you go back down, in your right mind here, here's a great passage to look up, you know, to help you out. No, I mean, he's showing him things, but John is familiar enough with the material. And he, you know, how do I get the point across? How do I describe what I've seen? Oh, yeah, there's that Apocalypse of Zephaniah thing. That's really useful, you know, or Daniel 7 or, you know, whatever. So he's going to use something, whether it's Old Testament or some other text that his readers know, to illustrate what this was like, what he was actually seeing. But he's going to tweak it too. He's going to make sure the theology of the deity of Jesus doesn't get lost. And even that he's going to show is consistent with Jewish two powers in heaven thinking. The risen Christ is the second power. Not some angel, whether it's a biblical angel or, you know, Second Temple Jewish literature angel. It's not these. It's none of these. It's him. Okay? It is the risen Christ who is the second power, and now he's the holder of the keys because of the resurrection. Again, all of this is happening in the book of Revelation. So, you know, you get to this, how does this inform our reading of Revelation 1:18? Four observations. It's absolutely clear that we have a risen Christ in view. Revelation 1:18. Fear not, I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades. So absolutely clear we have a risen Christ in view. Number two, It's also clear there's a sequence implied. I died. I'm now alive again forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades. 1, 2, 3. This follows that. Now, third, and this is important, this suggests, both the risen Christ and the sequence that's implied, suggests that before Jesus rose from the dead, he didn't have the keys to death and Hades. Somebody else did. And what these sources, especially Bass, are going to argue is that Jesus descended into the underworld at death. I died. He was there 3 days, during which time he did certain things. We've talked about this before, unseen realm. We talk about 1 Peter 3 with this, the descent into Sheol, into the underworld. So he's there 3 days, during which time he did certain things, one of which being that he conquered death and Hades, personified as supernatural enemies, and he took the keys from their domain, from their hands, as it were, rising from the dead. Now, after he rises, now he is Lord of the living and the dead. He holds the power of life and death. Something Revelation will make quite clear in judgment scenes later in the book that involve the second death. So consequently, what Revelation 1:18 is describing is Christ's descent into the underworld, his combat with and victory over death and Hades. This would have been crystal clear to ancient, again, literate readers. And the history of the church in this regard is telling. Here's the fourth point. Bass points out in detail that the idea that Christ descended into the underworld, descended into hell is the more familiar language through something like the Apostles' Creed, that this idea was a belief embraced by the confessing church across the world until the late 1400s, early 1500s. Everybody believed this. Everybody got it. And if you were an ancient reader, the supernatural outlook of all this in terms of the spiritual warfare and the conquering supernatural agents and again taking the keys from them, you know what it means. But we may have lost the detail in the history of the church, but we didn't lose the point, at least up until just right before the Reformation. Now, I think one of the reasons that it is so, it's so obvious. I mean, when you see it, when you hear, when you talk about it, when you think about it, and especially if you know the backgrounding of the Old Testament, Second Temple record, I mean, this is just obvious. That doesn't mean that Jesus went to hell, as in he gets a cell where he's going to be punished. See, that's the obstacle for a lot of readers today. He died. He goes to the place where the dead go, the underworld. We have to think of that place in that way. Again, what could be more obvious? But he doesn't remain there. He descended to hell, descended to the underworld is the better way to think about it, to the realm where the dead go. Well, duh, if he died, then where else would he go? Yeah, exactly. It's quite obvious. And again, everybody was locked in until, the late 1400s, okay? So this adds weight to, what I'm articulating in Unseen Realm in 1 Peter 3, where there I talk about how Enoch was a type of Christ in his descent. So not only does Christ preach to the imprisoned watcher spirits, reiterating their doom, but he also takes the lunch money from death and Hades. Okay, he's got stuff to do when he goes down to the underworld. First, I got to tell the watchers you ain't getting out, you might have think you've won after all this time, and your buddy's somewhere, some other evil spirit's going to let you out of here. Well, I got news for you. Yeah, you might be surprised to see me here, but I ain't going to be here long. You still lose, okay? And, okay, mission accomplished here. My work here is done. Now I'm going to go over to the gatekeepers, to death and Hades, and I'm going to take the keys from them, and sayonara. I mean, I'm out of here. He does certain things, and again, the early church, you could, Bass does a really nice job of showing this. They're locked into this. This wouldn't be news to them. But in our day and age, we've had a history of, this or that tradition or denomination, maybe even some that have removed the line from the Apostles' Creed or fiddled with the language or taught against it or something like that. They just missed the point. And they, just like with 1 Peter 3, they in some way kind of eviscerate the passage of its intended meaning. When Christ takes the keys, he takes control of everlasting life or death through his resurrection victory. What could be more obvious? Only he, from that point forward, has the authority over the living and the dead in the form of everlasting life and death. Again, what could be more obvious? Now, we have to ask here, we've got to transition to Revelation 3:7. How does this inform Revelation 3:7, the keys of David? There is, first of all, there is an intended parallel, literally, in the way John writes this. If you compare the flow of Revelation 1, the elements of what's described there, with the flow of Revelation 2 and 3, this comes out. For instance, if you're thinking about Revelation 1, 17, and 18, just think about the sequence here, or the sequence of the elements. I am the first and the last, even the living one, and I was dead, but behold, I now live forever and ever. I have the keys to death and Hades. If you go over to chapter 2, in verse 8, you read, thus says the first and the last. That's a parallel to Revelation 1:17. Continuing with 2:8, the one who died but came to life. Ah, there's a parallel with 1:18. If you go to chapter 3, you get this, verse 7, thus says the Holy One, the true one, the one who has the key of David. See, you would expect keys of death and Hades because they're parallel, but it changes. The wording slightly changes in 3:7. I'm the one who has the key of David, who opens so that no one can shut and shuts so that no one can open. Okay. So the parallel was intended to be noticed, the sequence. Now, Beale and Carson write this. Keys in 1:18b are keys of death, and he's in 3:7. A quotation, via 22:22, is substituted for the phrase of death and Hades. So now we have the one having the keys of David, who opens and no one shuts, and who shuts and no one opens. Okay, Isaiah 22:22. I mean, it's pretty obscure. Let's go to Isaiah 22, and I'm going to read verses. Let's start down in verse 15. And this is sort of a really obscure passage with an obscure person in it. But I'm going to read Isaiah 22:15 through 25. It says, thus says the Lord God of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is over the household, and say to him, what have you to do here, and whom have you here, that you have cut out here a tomb for yourself, you who cut out a tomb on the height and carve a dwelling for yourself in the rock? Behold, the Lord will hurl you away violently, O you strong man. God is angry with this particular steward, okay? He will seize firm hold on you, verse 18, and whirl you around and round and throw you like a ball into a wide land. Look, it's almost like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, okay? There you shall die, and there shall be your glorious chariots, you shame of your master's house. Gosh, that's brutal. Verse 19, I will thrust you from your office, and you will be pulled down from your station. How would you like that on your job review? You're a shame of your master's house. Verse 20, in that day, God says, when I punish this guy, in that day, I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your robe and will bind your sash on him and will commit your authority to his hand. And he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And I will place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open, and none shall shut. And he shall shut, and none shall open. Okay, there you get the part that John, you know, repurposes in Revelation 3. So Isaiah 20:22 has God getting rid of this one servant that's just the shame of your master's house, and replacing him with Eliakim. And he says, part of what he's going to do for this guy is, I'm going to give him the key of the house of David. So this guy's going to be like over the Davidic dynasty where they live. This guy's like over the house, okay? This is a big deal because it's the king, okay? He shall open and none shall shut. He shall shut and none shall open. Now, going back here to Revelation 3, like what in the world is John angling for, and how does this relate to the keys of death and Sheol, death and Hades? Let's think about what we just read. Eliakim. Probably, none of you named your kids Eliakim, but it's a name formed from El, which is God, and the verb cum, which is to raise up or rise up. Oh, now it's getting interesting. See, his name means El, or God will raise up. Boy, that's interesting in a passage that just referred to Jesus, you know, boy. You know, kind of interesting. John saw significance in Isaiah 22:15-25 because of the name and because of how Eliakim was described. So Beal and Carson write this. They say, the substitution key of David for the keys of death and Hades is meant to amplify the idea of the original phrase in 118b by underscoring the sovereignty that Christ holds over the sphere of death and Hades. Isaiah 22 describes Eliakim's absolute control over the kingdom of Israel, though eventually he is deposed from his office. I mean, Eliakim doesn't work out as well as, you know, God had wanted to. The reference, Beal and Carson continue, to Eliakim as my servant, did you catch that? My servant in Isaiah 22:20, would have been easily associated with Isaiah's servant prophecies of chapters 40 through 53. Since the phrase occurs there 13 times, the same phrase occurs only twice elsewhere in Isaiah in reference to the prophet himself in chapter 20, verse 3, and to David himself in Isaiah 37:35. The description of placing the key of the house of David, i.e., which equals the administrative responsibility for the kingdom of Judah, on Eliakim's shoulder, and the allusion to him as a father, did you catch that? To those who are in Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, and the reference to him as, again, catch the phrase, becoming a throne of glory. This is Isaiah 22. Those phrases would have facilitated such a typologically prophetic understanding of Isaiah 22:22, since this language is so strikingly parallel to that of the prophecy of the future Israelite ruler of Isaiah 9:6-7. The Messiah prophecy, the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Eternal Father, who sits on the throne of David. Thus, Eliakim's temporary control of the kingdom, historically, as prime minister to the king of Israel, was a prophetic historical pattern pointing forward to Jesus Christ's greater and eternal sovereignty over a greater kingdom. The kingdom, of course, you know, this is me now, this is the end of Beal and Carson. The kingdom, of course, is what? How is the kingdom? How does that work out in the book of Revelation for John? What's the kingdom? It's the new Eden. And how does this relate to having the keys of death and Hades? Because in the new kingdom, the kingdom coming, the new Eden, there is no more death. Hence, the key of David and the keys of death and Hades point to the same thing. Jesus is Lord of everlasting life and death. He alone has the authority to decide who goes where. Are you going to be in the new Eden? Are you going to be in the kingdom? Are you going to be in my house or not? So it's Jesus who offers and secured eternal life by defeating death. Everlasting death can only be experienced by rejecting that offer and the love of the key holder. I mean, these passages actually are speaking the same language. They're describing the same, not only destiny, that you're not going to die anymore. There is no more death. The key holder, okay, is going to deal with in terms of finality with both, you know, death. You know, just go to the end of the book of Revelation. I mean, death itself is destroyed, okay? The key holder is going to deal with death, and he's going to grant everlasting life to those who are aligned with him. It's the key imagery. It's sovereignty. It's eternal life. And that's why we get the David language is just another way of expressing this idea. You know, again, this is just fantastic stuff. You know, that again, I think this will be one of those episodes where you look back and you go, boy, there was just a lot planted in some simple phrases where, again, if you know the wider context, how death and hell, you know, the underworld are perceived, you know, as demonic figures, and you know, you have the descent idea because you have a sequence here. I was dead, you know, I died, and I'm alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. You know, there's the sequence here. Well, if there's a sequence here, then during the time he was down there, again, he took the keys away, which denotes kingship and authority, and you know, he's the Lord of the living and the dead, and you know, he gets to decide who goes where, and all this stuff is packed in to these phrases. And again, if you can, you know, grasp that wider context, this is, again, one of these other examples of Christ doing spiritual warfare, announcing the defeat, okay, of the keepers while he's down there. Okay. Just again, I'll go back to the phrase, taking their lunch money. Okay. He's smacking them around. Okay. They no longer have authority because of the resurrection. So it's just a fantastic set of images that we find that emerge really, you know, from a few simple phrases in these verses.
All right, Mike, another weird one, but it's awesome. I love them.
If it's weird, it must be important.
Hey, I love it. I love it. So next week we're getting into chapter 4. Any insights to that?
Yep. No, I don't want to tip anything off yet. I have to. You know, other than to say, you know, we're not trying to prop up or undermine any specific end times systems. But Revelation 4, of course, 4 and 5 are a unit. We've talked about this a little bit before. It's going to be a divine council scene. So we're going to revisit some of what we discussed when Alan Bandy was on the podcast. So that whole scene, again, we'll get into it specifically with an eye to Old Testament contributions to what's going on there.
All right, sounds good. Good. I can't wait to go back and listen to this episode, Mike, and look forward to the next one. All right, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.